So I'm here to talk to you about amphibian malformations, an emerging dilemma with unsolved issues. And so I've got a handout that I really want to go through first. And so this handout is basically what they call it is a field guide to malformations of frogs and toads. But it's really small, it's really short. And one of the neat things about it is it's got radiography. Pass the rest of them down. So not only does it have photos, but it's also got radiographs to show kind of what's going on the inside of the frog or toad. And this is available online through USGS. And all these photos are actually in color. I just didn't print it out in color. So this was published in February of 2000. And all the specimens are from 1997 to 1998. And they're from Minnesota, Vermont, Wisconsin, and Maine. And also, sorry, y'all have to forgive me. I've got a sinus infection about to begin, so I'm getting pretty rough. So it's got a pretty decent introduction just about malformations, the history of it. I'll get into that a little bit later. And then a glossary with all the scientific terms as well as the definitions of those. And then it really gets into a lot of different types of malformations, several pages worth. And then one of the most important things I think it has is like a second to last page is abnormalities, not malformations. So a lot of people will find a frog missing a leg and say, oh, it's malformed. Automatically jump to that conclusion. But it could be predator-induced or it could be a malformation. So they talk about that. They talk about trauma, lacerations, ulcers, stuff like that. So that's, you know, that's another good thing to have. So you can reference this, because, I mean, this is small enough to where if you go out in the field, especially working with frogs and toads, you can easily take this with you. On the back page, it's got basically a checklist of what you found, what side it was on. There's some diagrams to illustrate anything else you need to on the frog. So overall, it's a pretty good handout. Another thing I wanted to get to before we started was Dr. Gray asked how many people had ever had frog legs, and only a couple of us said that we had. It made me sad inside. So, I got frog legs, straight from Asia. So, cookies about an hour ago. Down the bottom, if you like Dale salt, or if you like them just a little bit saltier, there's about four pair that are salty. So everybody gets at least one pair, and then there's like five or six extra pair. So just pass them around. Oh, I know it, I love it. Oh yeah, of course it does. I've got some just to absorb the moisture that might have come off of it, but I don't have a whole lot. You can rip them up in between everybody. Nice little bib. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it tastes a good bit like chicken. I hope they're good. I haven't tried one yet, so I hope they're good. All right, now I'll turn this off. Y'all can eat, be full, and then just have a nice nap. All right, so lecture outline for today. Basically, I'm going to go through the history of malformations, then basically talk about the three main causes that have been speculated to cause most of the malformations, in-depth detail on each topic, things that you can do to help, and references. All right, so start out, malformations in amphibians. So here's your typical run-of-the-mill bullfrog. So what we're going to look at today is basically what makes this turn into stuff like this. So the history of malformations. The earliest reports of frog malformations go all the way back to the 1700s. There's not an exact date with that, just a rough estimate of 1700s. Now, in the mid-1990s, a group of school children from southern Minnesota were out participating in a science experiment with wetlands and wildlife. And the kids noticed that several northern leopard frogs were severely malformed. And so this hit the news presses big time, especially since it was associated with children. It really hit the news presses across North America, got big publicity. So then federal, state, and academic labs started to look at this and really try to start coming up with ways of why this is really happening, basically reach the root of the problem. And a lot of work has been done with this species, which is the Pacific tree frog. And both of these show malformations. This is a better shot. It's the silhouette showing the malformation of the hind limbs. Okay, so some of the current data. I'm basically going to talk about one site in particular, which is the Northern Prairie Wildlife Research Center. And so this center is actually located in Jamestown, North Dakota, and it's funded by USGS, and it was opened in 1966. Since it's open, it's received over... Oh, now it's not going to do it. Okay, 1,959 malformed frogs, comprising 54 species, includes 44 states and 4 Canadian provinces. Now, the most common is northern leopard frog. And northern leopard frog is actually making up 35.3% of all malformed frogs that they recorded. Second, green frog with 14.9%, and then bullfrog with 10.1%. So that's just one site, which is basically kind of like a center point where people bring a lot of malformed frogs and report malformed frogs, and that kind of gives you an idea of basically what's going been going on within since 1966 at least. So I'll talk about some of the types of malformations.
Yo.
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems to kind of vary because depending on the cause that's associated with it, depends on whether it's more frequent in large pools or large ponds or just ephemeral pools, what type of species. I really think it's probably because these are the most common, especially northern leopard frog, green frog, and bullfrog. I mean, those are the three most common species, I would say, in the north. And so basically, I think that probably has something to do with it. But I can't really say one way or the other whether it's definitely this or definitely that. But I'd say the commonness of all three of those species definitely has something to do with it. All right, so the types of malformations. So eye abnormalities. And this is a wood frog. I actually caught, Jason was there, and I think Chris was there. And it was up in Rome Mountain State Park last semester. He had a malformed eye. And then you got incomplete tail resorption. There's polymelia, which is extra limbs. Polydactyly, which is extra digits. Other types include amelia, which is missing limbs. Ectromelia, which is missing limb segments. Etrodactyly, which is missing digits, like in this northern dusky from Ohio. And then there's a lot of other, just all kinds of different malformations, whether it be skin webbing, bony triangles, all kinds of stuff. So here's a malformed limb, looks like a northern leopard frog. Here's gular projections, looks like a bony triangle here. A deformed tail. This is actually a Pacific tree frog that one of its eyes didn't emerge. I found a lot of these photos, at least with this species. And a lot of people think, since there's tons of photos, that it just occurs in adults. But I mean, there's plenty of evidence that it occurs in tadpoles as well. And then here's a tadpole with polymelia and polydactyly. And then some individuals just really don't have much anything except for the front two legs. They found this, and I think this was actually broadcast on a CNN special a few years back, talking about some of the malformations that's been going on. And that actually was alive. It wasn't dead. That was alive. So some of the most common characteristics. Aneurons are the most commonly affected taxa. Usually multiple species are infected. Most occur in hind limbs. usually involve deletion of the hind limbs or limb segments. It can affect multiple geographic ranges, so it's not just restricted valleys or uplands. It can go wherever. And effects can be consistently observed through several years. So, I want to look at what really causes these malformations. And clear frog that, like we learned about with Liz, she told us kind of what they do to clear these frogs. Okay, so, chemical contaminants is one of the first things, followed by UV radiation, and then parasitic trematodes. And I'll go in depth of all three. So, we'll start out with chemical contaminants. Now, when I'm talking about chemical contaminants, basically I'm talking about agricultural chemicals like Roundup, and then industrial pollutants like PCBs. So, there's been relatively few studies assessing the chemical impacts on malformations or on malformed frogs. Basically, most of the studies have been on chemical toxicities. Like we saw with Dr. Relier's, there was a lot of information on, you know, how toxic some of these pesticides and insecticides are, and herbicides. And some other herbicides haven't even been studied. Some pesticides haven't been studied. So really, most of the data has just dealt with toxicity and really not as far as the malformation side of it. But there have been some studies published, and there is some literature out there that states that chemical contaminants are causing malformations. But like Dr. Relia said, there's a lot of lethal effects. They increase, especially with predators like he showed and stuff like that. In fact, I think one of his studies, he had wolf, or well, actually, I'll get into that later. But so they don't just have to have lethal effects, though. He emphasized the lethal effects, but they also have sublethal effects like malformations. Ouellet et al. In 1997 was doing a study on agricultural fields. I think almost all of them were cornfields. And he found amphibian limb defects as high as 69% in some species. I think that 69% was northern leopard frog, and 66% I believe in green frog. But the problem with this study was that the range was from 0 to 69% depending on species. So they couldn't definitively say that it was because of chemical contaminants, because most of their percentages were 20% and below. In fact, there was a large jump from like 20 or 30% up to 66%. And there was really nothing in between. So, go ahead.
Was that a survey?
It was, I believe, a survey. Yeah, I think it was a survey. Yeah. Because he was surveying all the cornfields in a certain area. So they couldn't definitely say that chemical contaminants were the cause of those malformations. So basically, most pesticide-induced malformations, and not just pesticide, but any chemical contaminant, involves the hind limbs. So does anybody know why it might involve mainly the hind limbs and not the forelimbs? Any guesses? That's basically it. That's what is speculated. What happens with the forelimbs is they're developed in the parabranchial sacs within the branchial chamber of the tadpole, and they emerge at Gossner stage 42. Well, with the hind limbs, on the other hand, they're developed outside of the body chamber from the time the limb buds form. So what's been speculated is that it's exposure differences, these hind limbs being exposed for longer durations of time to chemical contaminants, thus being more likely to cause the malformations in the hind limbs versus the forelimbs. Okay, so it's also been shown that they might not be directly causing malformations. They might have synergistic effects with things like temperature and also things like pH. The reason I say this basically is because pesticides and insecticides and herbicides, specifically, because that's what's been studied mostly, are they affect the neural system, especially herbicides like Roundup, affects the nervous system. So what happens is they really stress the immune system of the amphibians, and when you add that in with something like temperature or pH or even predators like Dr. Relier added in, you know, the consequences may be lethal or they may be sublethal. Basically, just a summary, little work has really been done. There's plenty of work left to do because basically right now we're at the stage where we're just beginning to look at these chemical contaminants, and most of the work is really looking at how toxic these are to amphibians because we really don't know. Like Dr. Relier said, we don't know a whole lot about really what's going on inside the amphibians and what these pesticides are doing. And also another reason we need more work done is because some think that chemical contaminants don't cause malformations at all. Ankley et al., 2004, stated that. In fact, they ruled out chemical contaminants and UV radiation and just said that parasitic trematodes were the only cause. So refer to that study for more information. But basically, data is still inconclusive. We really don't know what's going on with these amphibians and the pesticides and why they're causing some malformations. Okay, so I'm going to go now to UV radiation. And when I talk about UV radiation, there's three types of UV radiation. But mostly I'm talking about UVB. UVB radiates at wavelengths of 280 to 315 nanometers. Above 315 nanometers is UVA, and below 280 to 200 is UVC. And so there's recent increase in radiation, and this has been speculated to be caused by stratospheric ozone depletion. And what's thought to happen is that stratospheric ozone actually absorbs some of the lower wavelengths like UVC and up into some of the UVB wavelengths. So with this degradation of stratospheric ozone, more UVB is reaching the surface of the Earth and then causing stuff like UVB effects, which can include for amphibians cell death. It can include slower growth rates. It could impair the immune system. And there's various other sublethal effects, like malformations. And amphibians are at a high risk. And does anybody really know or take a guess at why amphibians would be at a higher risk than, say, a mammal or a bird? Yeah, that's probably kind of one of the first ones. What are you going to say? They are low on the food chain, but one thing that's different with amphibians is I'll get to that in a minute. We'll touch on the skin in just a minute.
Exposure differences.
And basically, the biggest thing is amphibians go to open, shallow pools with warm water, lay their eggs. The eggs are usually exposed in bright sunlight because with that warmer temperature, developmental growth rates are faster. So they can develop faster, hatch out, and then grow faster, and then get out of the pool. Well, there's a trade-off of being able to grow faster, and that's exposed to UV. And so, you know, with birds, the eggs are covered up, and then, you know, they've got feathers, so they're more protected. Mammals, you know, they don't really have to worry about it anyways. But with amphibians, the eggs really have no protection, except for a few things that I'll get into a little bit later. Okay, so basically some things that UV can induce, it can occur in all life stages. It's been proven from early embryonic stages all through adult stages that malformation can occur anytime due to UVB. And there's actually some studies that show that early exposure, like in egg stages, actually can cause delayed effects. So one study that was done was on Rhanum temporaria, which is a European common frog, and the embryos were taken and exposed to UVB. Well, the UVB for the eggs caused no effect on survivorship, developmental abnormalities, or hatching size. Once they hatched, though, the larvae had increased frequency of abnormalities, metamorphosed later, and were smaller than the average Rhanum temporaria. So basically, there's something going on there that, you know, necessarily didn't kill them, but it did have some sublethal effects, like metamorphosis later, you know, increased abnormalities, stuff like that.
What were the abnormalities?
I'm trying to think back to that study. You know, I can't remember. I've seen too many studies. But
is it on your
No. Mm-mm. But there are some sublethal effects. These might have been some of them. I might have taken some of these straight from that. That might be it. And then I know some of these others from different sources. But so some sublethal effects can be blistering. It can cause edema, so swelling of organs or in the body cavity. Some studies have documented scoliosis. So basically they get deformed and curved bodies. And then retinal damage as well has been documented. And this has been kind of speculated to affect them maybe for detecting prey or detecting predators. It's not really sure. There's not a whole lot done with it. Yeah.
But the scoliosis, is it actually affecting the vertebrae, their spine?
Yeah.
Or is that staying straight?
It's actually affecting their spine, and they're supposed to be whether, and it's kind of weird because they document it as to whether it's curved to the left or the right. And that's the only two documentations of it. So obviously it's having something to do with the vertebrae, but just the left or the right. I don't know if it can do any other things, but that's the only thing I've seen. Yeah.
Is it similar to
human? You know, I don't know if that terminology is the same or not. I would expect so. I would expect so because, I mean, it's the same scientific term, but I don't know if it's just a broad application of the word or not. But, yeah, that's the word that several studies use. And yeah, it is in that field guide as well. Okay, so like chemical contaminants, UVB can actually have synergistic effects with stuff like temperature and pH to cause developmental effects, whether it be they develop later, they develop not at all in some extensions. Decreased hatching success. So there's been studies that have shown with temperature and UVB, there's a decreased hatching success. And that was a couple papers. Okay, that's it. So UVB defenses that amphibians evolved. There's plenty of amphibian defenses. I picked some of the some general ones and then a few more specific. So one of the basic general ones that amphibians have evolved is habitat selection. So not only where they live, but also where they lay their eggs. So they can live in dense forest, muddy water, deep water, and crevices. And especially muddy water, deep water, and crevices, well, water and deep water they can lay eggs or live in. And then deep water and crevices they can live in there and can do everything in forest. But these do different things. Like dense forest really restrict sunlight and scatter it because the sunlight hits the leaves and it scatters and diffuses to the ground. Crevices don't allow any light in. But what happens with muddy water is you've got suspended particles and the light comes in, it's diffracted and shot everywhere, and UVB is diffracted as well, so it doesn't penetrate the eggs as much because it's diffracted so much. And with deep water, and don't quote me on the chemistry because this is just what I read from a couple of papers, but supposedly there's more organic carbon the deeper you go in the water. And what happens is that organic carbon is actually supposed to absorb certain wavelengths of UVB. And so the deeper the water you go, the more UVB is absorbed by that dissolved carbon. There's also stuff like egg-laying behavior. So Tetrurus marmoratus, the marble newt, what it'll do is the eggs are super sensitive to UVB. It'll lay the eggs in dense forest or in somewhat open forest, but then it'll take the eggs and actually roll them up in leaves to protect them from UVB. Excuse me. I don't know if they've always done it or not. It's a kind of a tough question. I don't know. Well, see, I don't know. It seems to be more, the paper that I was reading said it was more of just UVB because the eggs are extremely susceptible to UVB. But,
yeah, but then that's they can sense an increased amount of UVB and then make a conscientious decision.
Yeah, and that's pretty Yeah.
I mean, that might be possible.
Yeah.
I guess what Jason was mentioning is, did they have UVB radiation treatment and control?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Probably a lack of, or believe the lack.
Yeah.
They always do that, maybe in response to avoid predation. And that's an added benefit.
Yeah. And I know the phyla medusa, this species can lay their eggs curled up in leaves. And the weird thing about this is the egg characteristic. If they lay them curled up in leaves, they actually don't develop any pigmentation. But if they lay them just on leaves that aren't curled up, they actually develop a dark pigmentation. And that kind of goes into the melanin that Somai was getting to. Basically, it's been thought that melanin, whether it be in the adults or in the eggs or in the larval stages, acts as kind of like an amphibian sunscreen. It kind of absorbs the UVB radiation and kind of prevents most of it from absorbing into further layers of the skin. I don't really know how much data has been provided on the actual effects of melanin, how much it absorbs UVB. Okay, so UVB summary. Malformations have definitely been documented. It can occur in all life stages, from adults to the embryonic stages. There's tons of defenses that have evolved, but more data is needed. And I cite this Bridges and Boone paper in 2003 because it's really interesting. I would suggest you read it if you have any time. They showed that with increased levels of UVB or with carbaryl, which is a pesticide, that there's actually increased in survivorship. And I think they even had tadpoles growing better. And it was kind of interesting. Their UVB, what they did was they used mesocosms of basically the cattle tanks. And they limited UVB exposure by putting different types of plastic over the mesocosms to allow different amounts of UVA or UVB filtrating through. That's kind of an iffy study to me, and I didn't really have time to go into the specifics of it and research it further. So that's the only study that I found like that. So basically, obviously, more data is needed because we really don't know what's going on if they found that survivorship has increased. Do you know anything about that?
I have read it for a while.
Okay. Yeah, it's the way it seems is, at least all the documentation that I found, UVB was developing and also, you know, having other sublethal effects like decrease in hatching size, stuff like that. But it's more of like just not really affecting them as much, like edema, like blisters, stuff like that. All the reports showed a good bit of it, but it wasn't the typical malformations you're talking about, like with the chemicals or with the parasites, where they have, you know, six extra legs. And go ahead.
Do you think it has something to do with the fact that it's built on itself, the UVB? I mean, they're getting more and more, so they're not getting like this huge dose at one time.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They're like, it's building up over their lifetime, so maybe that's why it causes these leaser.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. And I think you kind of covered this a little bit, but so UVBs are coming through more. I mean, why are UVAs or Cs not affecting UVBs?
Basically, I think it has to do with the wavelength at which they're emitting. So for some reason, this UVB is in the perfect wavelength to cause stuff like this, but the UVA and the UVC is not. In fact, UVA is what most amphibians, reptiles use for their diurnal patterns. That's what they use to tell that it's what time of day it is and stuff like that, and what season it is based on the UVA wavelengths. So that is really not detrimental. I don't know anything about UVC. I know nothing about UVC at all. So I don't know if it has any type. I didn't find anything in the literature about UVC except for its wavelength. So I didn't find anything else about it. Yeah. So basically, once again,
yeah.
We don't know. Yeah. Another thing is, see the PrimeNet website? I'll get to that later in my references. The PrimeNet website, if you're interested in just the UVB talk, it is a neat website to see because it's over the 14, well, there's 14 national parks that they have been monitoring for UVB. And I can't remember when they actually started this monitoring. It's a long-term process, and they've been monitoring places like the Great Smoky Mountains, like the Rockies, Denali, Glacier, the Everglades, a lot of different places. And they've got a website up where you can go and look at different parks. Look at how it's increased over time. They've got nice fancy graphs. They've got nice fancy maps, all kinds of stuff. So it's a neat website if you're interested in getting a little bit more just about how UVB has actually increased over time. Okay, so now I'm going to actually jump into trematodes. All right. So, Rubiararia ondatre. That's my butchering of the scientific name. So it's in the phylum Platyhelminthes. The class Trematoda, order is Rubiararia, and this family is Psilostomatidae, and basically they're flukes. They are flattened and oval in shape, and they have two suckers, and the adults use these two suckers to attach to the host. More general information includes that they're the most visible and abundant parasites infecting North American anurans. Numerous species have been documented infecting numerous amphibian species. They have a complex life cycle involving multiple hosts. And the interesting fact is they have no anus. So all waste has to be excreted orally. All right, so trematode history. First recorded link to amphibians malformations is in 1990. This is in Santa Clara County in California, and it was done by Sessions and Ruth. And the next one was actually with Johnson. Let me go back to the Sessions and Ruth. I'll give you a little bit more information about that. I think they were at one site, and they found over 50% of all frogs present had multiple limbs. And once they got looking into it further, they actually found that trematodes was the cause of it. Then Johnson et al. In 1999 confirmed trematodes causing malformations. And then this other one, Loeffler et al. 2001, was actually really interesting because they looked at different museum specimens throughout the United States. And way back, and the earliest dated they were in 1946 is when they documented trematodes. It took all kinds of preserved amphibian species, looked at them, and determined that the earliest that they could find was 1946 for trematodes infecting anurans. There's numerous other studies, though. Tons of literature on trematodes. Not just in this genus. There's tons of other genuses. There's rare ones that they've never recorded infecting anurans. There's plenty of studies with this genus and this specific species. So there's been a good bit of work with trematodes. So basically, I want to talk about how this causes this. And what papers usually refer to is with this. And so what they talk about is the trematode life cycle. So here's a couple graphs of the life cycle. So what happens is the first stage is an egg stage right here. And it's secreted by wading birds and their feces. Then, snails in the genus Planorbella and biome Filaria actually become infected when the eggs hatch in the Myrisidia. They invade the snail's tissue, and then, once inside the snails, the Myrisidia develop into Rediae. sorry, they reproduce asexually and produce large numbers of mobile cercariae. So here's the radiae, here's the cercariae. And then the cercariae actually infect and penetrate the tissues surrounding the limb buds of the tadpoles. Then they cause malformations. And here's tadpole and then adult malformations. And then the malformed frogs are predated by the wading birds. Now, there's been speculation as to whether this is an intentional cause of the trematodes or an accidental cause. Why it would be an intentional cause is because it's hard to escape a predator if you have six extra legs, or if you don't have any eyes, or you know, if your leg is back behind your back. So basically these deformities facilitate predation a whole lot easier than these wading birds, you know, eat these anurans, the trematodes hatch out into the wading bird, become sexually mature, make eggs, the life cycle starts over again. And so some of the habitat types that trematodes have been recorded in, drying pools, ephemeral ponds, permanent ponds, large lakes, basically anywhere that anurans could be found. And some of the means of spreading include wading birds, like we already talked about, but also another type. And these are just two general species that I'll talk about, but basically it's from introducing non-indigenous species to other areas. So what's happened, especially with brown trout, is brown trout's not even native to North America, but it's been spread across North America for fisheries. And then, of course, like we talked about with bullfrog, native to the eastern United States, but been spread. I think it's actually present on every continent except for Antarctica. Isn't that right, Dr. Buell? Or Dr. Gray?
Oh.
Sorry. Okay, so. Okay, so is it correct to say that this species can be found on every continent but Antarctica? Okay. All right. So basically, what the problem is, fish is another vector of trematodes. So both of these are vectors of trematodes. They can be infected, and then when they get transported to another site for maybe fisheries reintroduction or for, you know, starting of a new frog aquaculture, stuff like that, it can spread the trematode across continents even, and then wading birds just facilitate spreading across wetlands. Some of the factors that increase trematode infection include stuff like chemical contaminants, increased density, limited food resources, which basically is related to increased density, because when you have increased density of tadpoles, your food resources are going to start to be limited, but also predator locality. Now, all four of these act on tadpoles the exact same way. So you may know what all four of these would do to a tadpole that would make trematode infections more likely. That's it. What these do is they stress the immune system, like I talked about with chemical contaminants. They put stress on the individual because the individual is trying to get more food, or is competing, or is scared to death of a predator. Like, for instance, Dr. Rick Relier's, one of his papers, he had wood frogs. And when he introduced the predator alone, the smell of the predator increased mortality of wood frogs by like 80%. So just the smell of the predator alone stressed the tadpoles enough to where they started starving to death. So basically, they're going to start to stress out. And then once they're stressed, they don't have any ability to fight off trematodes. Trematodes can come and infect the limb buds. And when I talk about fighting off trematodes, there's been a lot of interesting stuff that's been done with how tadpoles actually try to fight off individual trematodes. And it seemed like they can almost sense the trematodes infecting them. And there's been some studies where they actually introduce trematodes to the environment, and amphibians start to run into the glass and start to beat and rub their sides against the glass and stuff like that. And they actually have reaction from the trematode. So obviously they're trying to fight it off. But when you're worried more about being eaten by a predator, then that's pushed to the wayside. And so trematodes can affect more easily. So trematode summary. It definitely caused malformations. There's plenty of studies that have shown it. Okay.
Let's discuss some other things. Did you read any of Johnson and Jonathan Jason's you're right with respect to those things that you proposed there, but one of the areas where trematode infections are strongly correlated with are in eutrophied systems. And you didn't read anything about those?
I didn't. I know there was some. There is some out there. Johnson? I know Johnson. Johnson's got some eutrophication stuff. Yeah, I did read that study. It's in my works cited.
I'm kind of going slow in case it like jogs or something.
I can't remember.
So that is one of the intermediate hosts. Intermediate hosts.
Yeah.
So you have an increase in the number of snails.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. So basically, what happens with you get an algal bloom, you get increased nutrients, you get the algal bloom, the snails take off. Then what happens with the snails is there's more ability to actually have more eggs, get infected more often. More infections from the snails mean more hatch out, more tadpoles get infected, and it goes up, and it increases, because then wading birds start the cycle all over again. Yeah, I remember reading that study, and it is in my works cited, just in case you want to look at that too.
Yeah. So did you all get that? Basically, it's the first intermediate host. So there's two intermediate hosts. You have the definite host, which is the adult wading bird. Then you have first intermediate host being the snails, and then second intermediate host being the tadpole.
So yeah, here's the egg stage, and then the first intermediate host.
Then second.
Biome filaria too.
They're all planorbids.
Oh, okay, yeah. I thought you were talking about that. Yeah, I don't think this genus though, do they? I don't think it's this genus.
I'm pretty sure that.
Yeah, there's a lot of trematodes out there. Okay. I got a few.
Okay.
Just a couple summaries and references and stuff.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You're on the clock. All right. Did you read Kiesecker's work with respect
yes.
to you? Okay. So what did he find with respect to the I believe the exposed them to predators?
I cannot remember. I read a lot of papers.
Well, I mean, it was right in line.
It's somewhere in here.
Basically, just the presence of a predator resulted in an increase in trematode infection.
In fact, that's probably where I got that one then. Yeah, because I know that's one of my references too. Is that one? So that's probably where I got that. All right. So the summary. Definitely caused malformations. Lots of data present, like we've been talking about. Plenty of studies. Plenty of documentation. Spread easily through various vectors. And okay, now I didn't say this, I got this from another paper. It's speculated to be the most important concern of amphibian malformations. So basically, it might be the most important concern that causes amphibian malformations. That's a really, really touchy subject, and I would never say that big of a generalization about anything. I mean, yeah, we know a good bit about it, but there's so much other stuff that we don't know about that I wouldn't make that, but I wanted to at least make it available. See if you agree with that or not.
Well, I mean, you throw that out provided some pretty solid evidence that in some cases that may be the case, in other cases it
might not be. Yeah.
Did you summarize any of his information?
No. Well, yeah, scattered in here. I didn't specifically cite most of the things.
One thing that I have kind of gotten is, and that is a consequence of where a lot of the research has focused, if you focus on treatment of this driver of malformations, but from the stuff that Lanou has recently been summarizing and discussing, it's probably, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, chemicals can may be responsible for a substantial number of malformations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically more data is needed. Treatment toads seem to be the most important vector, but really I think it's almost a combination of multiple factors, because you've got stuff like temperature, which has been caused to increase malformations from Bufo vulgaris, which is a common toad, if raised at 30 degrees Celsius, which is 86 degrees Fahrenheit. So malformations induced just because raised by 30 degrees Celsius, which is not that warm water. pH, deformities have been caused when pH was lowered to a pH of 4. You've got all kinds of abiotic and biotic factors like predators inducing stress and may infect or affect treatment toad infections, stuff like that. And the presence of one or more of these that I've already mentioned is definitely going to increase malformations, but to say it's definitely one or definitely another is really just a broad statement. I really think we need to kind of step back and look and say, there's a ton of stuff that's going on here. And this is kind of what Dr. Relier's kind of been getting at, because he's really been looking at, okay, so we said that insecticides and pesticides were dangerous to certain animals. We never tested amphibians. Then we tested amphibians with predators and stuff like that, competition, and it dropped the LC50 dramatically. And so we really don't know a whole lot about really what's going on with certain things like chemical contaminants, like UV radiation. And I think, and the research is headed there, but I mean, we've just now started. If you look at most of the papers in my works cited, which I'll hand out in a minute, almost every one of them, in fact, every one of them but one is from 2000 on, because the work's really just now being started. I mean, it takes a few years to implement a plan, a few years to try to get funding or publish it. So it takes a few years just to even get the study out. But so since it's just emerged in like 1996, I think is when the Minnesota kids found that, you know, we haven't had a whole lot of time yet to basically say this is definitely what's driving malformations. So it's a changing kind of a hot, sexy topic right now. And I mean, a lot of data and a lot of money is being poured into this right now, and it's evolving dramatically. So basically what you can do, report any mass malformations to state or academic professionals. I say mass, because if you find one or two malformed frogs, it's not that big of a deal, because 5% of all amphibians are deformed. So that's just kind of a genetic type of cause. So if you find one or two, it's not that big of a deal, but if you start finding, you know, 10, 20, 30 frogs malformed, that's a pretty big concern. And you can also report to the North American Reporting Center for Amphibian Malformations. And that's on the next slide. So here's some helpful websites. Here's the Northern Prairie Wildlife Research Center website that I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture. The PrimeNet website, that was the parks that were monitoring the UVB. Then you got the North American Reporting Center for Amphibian Malformations and Deformities in North American Amphibians. That website right there is awesome, because it's got a good little bit of general information, but the best thing I like about that is it's got a catalog of deformities on the left, and then on the right it's got several really high quality pictures that you can actually click on and blow up even larger. It tells you a lot about the species, it tells you about the location, what was wrong with it, when it was collected, if they've got that information. Really interesting site, and some of my pictures came from that site. It was a really nice website, nicely put together. Some reference books included Amphibian Decline, like Dr. Gray was talking about, on Mike Lanou. This is this bad boy right here. This has got just an awesome load of information. It's got specific papers. It's got general information. It's got species records. It's got just a load of information from a lot of different authors compiled into one pretty expensive book. So you might want to look at it from Dr. Gray, but it's pretty expensive. It's on the pricey side. Another one is Amphibian Medicine and Captive Husbandry. This is available at the library. This is, actually, I think the library's copy that Dr. Hooverman's got right now. Another good resource. It's got a lot about the trematodes. It's got a lot about diseases. Actually, both of those books got a good little bit about trematodes in there. And then this other one, Wildlife Diseases, this small book, I could not find this anywhere on the internet. I couldn't even find it to get a photo, much less get a price range on Amazon.com or Half.com. I don't know where you got it at, but I couldn't find it. So, okay, all right. So you can get it directly from the publisher, but I couldn't find it online at all. So those two books are online. I think both of them average about $130. And then that one, I have no clue. Some other references. So I'll pass out my work cited. I highlighted some of the best ones, some of the most interesting ones, like one from Johnson, Ankley et al., stuff like that. There's some of them. More references. There's some more. I've got them all, if you want them, in this big book. So if you want to just kind of flip through it, I've got them all highlighted and drawn all over and everything else. So if you want your own copy, there's the citations of all of them. And with that, I'll take any questions.
You have 3 minutes for me.
You got 3 minutes for questions. What?
Probably.
Oh, well, good. Okay. Also, I've got some cleared frogs from Deb Miller. I've also got Rarity Texas Tech from Dr. Matthew Gray. This is actually some that he collected. So I've got some of those. And so some of these are malformed, and then some of these are not. They're just regular frogs. So I can pass those out if you want, or you can come up and look at them. But here they are. So with that, I guess I'm done.